Welcome to Plastics Unwrapped, a series supported by Dow, the materials science company. I'm your host, Maitri Sitharaman. In this podcast, we're on the hunt for solutions to some of the toughest challenges facing the plastics industry. I'll be joined by my producer, Lisa Desai.
Hey, everyone.
She's the woman with all the facts and figures we're going to be talking about. We're going to try and have some seriously honest conversations with guests from across sectors and from across the world. So let's together figure out what it'll really take to save the future of our planet.
We look at conservation and our conservation work not just as saving a species, but it's really about saving the entire ecosystem.
Biodiversity. Well, it's life on Earth as we know it, from our genetics and bacteria to entire ecosystems like forests and coral reefs. It's basically 4.5 billion years of evolution that's now being impacted and reshaped, and not in positive ways, by humans. This web of life, well, it gives us our food, our water, medicine, a stable climate, and frankly, therefore, a stable economy. At the heart of helping us understand this web that binds us all, through learning about our closest cousins, the chimpanzees, has been the incredible Dame Jane Goodall.
In 1960, a young British woman ventured into the forests of Africa to follow her childhood dream, to find a way to watch free wild animals living their own undisturbed lives. She left everything familiar behind and ended up giving the world a remarkable window into our closest living relatives. She was me. I wanted to come as close to understanding animals as I possibly could.
I don't know how she does it, Lisa, but every time I hear Jane Goodall's voice, I seem to care so much more for this planet and life on it.
I think that's because she made some really key connections for all of us, and she really showed us how human chimps are. They wage war, they hunt, and they show compassion. But I think the biggest thing that Jane taught us is how over-farming near the chimps' habitats has led to this massive biodiversity loss. And that just comes around full circle and affects us and every corner of the ecosystem.
And that's what really is special about Jane, isn't it? Because she made that connection about biodiversity and people, the biggest risk to our climate. Now, over the years, I have to say, Lisa, the Jane Goodall Institute is not just about chimpanzees anymore. They've expanded their mission to really drive home this broader story of conservation of our biodiversity. Joining us is Anna Rathman, Executive Director of the Jane Goodall Institute in the United States. Anna comes to us with a massively long career and a distinguished career in philanthropy and conservation. She spent, I'd say, donkey's years at the National Geographic Society. She was at one point even a seasonal ranger at the Yellowstone National Park and, of course, set up the Great Plains Conservation Foundation. Anna, welcome to the show. Does conservation right now feel like a losing battle because there are so many competing interests? And how does JGI fit into this picture?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to join you today for this conversation. Really appreciate being able to share a little bit about our work and Jane's approach to conservation and these very complex subjects. So thank you for that. Are we losing? What I would say is no. We are still fighting. This is still a topic and a conversation that we're having. You know, Jane often talks about how when we look at something, whether it's very complex and the odds seem insurmountable, that's where the most opportunity lies. And that's when we really dig in. She uses the phrase to gird our loins, to really stand firm in our commitment to making positive impacts and finding solutions together.
And it talked to us about how the Jane Goodall Institute really works in conservation, because the assumption is that, you know, Jane, chimpanzees, primates, but you do much more than that, don't you?
We do. We do. And you're right to call out chimpanzees. We think of chimpanzees as our keystone species. It's the one that is most closely associated with Jane. You know, you often think of Jane, these images of her in the forests of Western Tanzania come up amongst the chimpanzees. And that's because of Jane's work researching chimpanzees, really redefining the definition between humans and other animals in our environment that she did in Western Tanzania of what is now Gombe Stream National Park. So the Jane Goodall Institute is privileged and honored to continue that work today. It's been going for over 60 years. It's the longest running wild animal research site in the world. But as you point out, we have much more expansive mission. And that mission is a manifestation. As Jane learned more about the interconnectedness of the ecosystems and the environment, she expanded her own work within the Institute. So we work very closely with communities because they are absolutely integral to preserving and protecting these environments where the chimpanzees live.
So how do you work with communities, and what do you do to connect them to the environment around them?
We work with communities through a framework that Jane and the collaborators within the Jane Goodall Institute developed several decades ago, and we refer to it as TACARE, or to take care. And what TACARE is when we are invited into the communities and into the landscapes to partner with them on this large initiatives that are holistic. We look at conservation and our conservation work not just as saving a species, but it's really about saving the entire ecosystem. Humans are a part of that ecosystem. The plant life is a part of that ecosystem. So we use community mapping tools. We use advanced technologies when appropriate to bring in. But really what we do is a lot of listening to what the needs are of that community, what the priorities are of that community, and then ultimately how can we move towards a status where things are more in line, where the landscape is not being degraded, where all species are able to thrive, including people.
Degradation, waste, it's a huge issue in big cities. How much of a problem is it in the rural communities that you deal with? In Nigeria, for example, we heard about big cities having massive issues with getting rid of their plastic waste problem. How do your communities in the smaller rural areas and more remote areas deal with it?
Well, what I think is interesting when I think about some of our communities that we work with, particularly the ones who are very remote, what's always interesting to me is you may spend an entire day or multiple days coming to these communities and using various modes of transportation, right? Starting with maybe an airplane to get to that country, then you're going to get on a truck, presumably. Then you may be getting into a boat. After you're on that outboard boat, you may be getting into a dugout canoe, and then you may be walking. And so there are these, you know, various chapters in order to access and commune with some of these very remote communities. And when you get there, you are still surrounded by and in the presence of plastics, which is so interesting to think about, that plastics and the materials that we use every day in a city or elsewhere have really made their way all throughout the world, and even in these very remote areas. Now, when you get into those remote areas, obviously waste removal is an issue because they are so remote. And so what we often see is that those communities have their own kind of form of recycling and reusing. And you're not having these same issues around single-use plastic. A plastic bottle, the liquid is not just drunk and it's discarded. That plastic bottle has multiple lives after the liquid is used from within it. And that can serve as a really inspiring example of what we can do and the kind of innovation and ingenuity when you don't have access to some of these other programs that you have in metropolitan areas. And then finally, we talk at the Jane Goodall Institute a lot about hope and the power of hope, the importance of hope. That hope is the antidote to apathy. Hope we view as a verb. And we instill hope in the world through programs like Roots and Shoots. Roots and Shoots was started about 30 years ago with a small group of young Tanzanian people meeting with Jane and expressing how they felt despondent and that they were at a loss of what they could do for their environment and for their future.
I mean, you talk about Roots and Shoots as a program for young people to inspire them towards conservation. What are some of the really strong sticking points for them? And what is the strangest story that they've told you about a problem they just can't solve for?
Well, Roots and Shoots, first of all, is one of the most extraordinary programs that I've observed. I had an opportunity to meet with and visit a very vibrant Roots and Shoots community. And what the young people had done as part of the project that week, and they had been doing this for several months, was because this was a coastal community, it was a beach cleanup. You know, we see these all over the world in coastal communities. And they had done a beach cleanup, and they had collected quite a bit of plastic waste that had washed up onto their local beach. And then the project was, we're all going to sort it, and we're going to put it in bags so that we can then, you know, do the next step. And as we finished sorting it at the school, one of the teachers, one of the administrators, took me to the side and said, you know, we do this and the children love doing this and they know that they're making the world more beautiful, more healthy beaches, that the marine life aren't going to, you know, they're removing the plastic from the marine environment. But then we don't know what to do with it from here. And that really struck a chord with me, because here we are asking people to join us, inviting people to make these positive impacts. But if we don't have a full solution through the whole value chain, through the whole supply chain of, okay, now we've collected it, now we've sorted it, but then we get to a now what? That's where we really need the help. We need that support and that bridge so all of us can make that positive impact.
That's where the circularity bit always gets stuck, isn't it? Where we have the conservationists who seem to be doing X, and then you have the companies who are talking about the recycling, the waste management companies and all the rest. And in between, you have government saying, oh, we don't have the infrastructure. Why aren't we all sitting down and just talking about building that infrastructure together? Is that what's the missing link, you think?
Yes, please. I love that you are asking that question, because one of the things that I think is such a misnomer, both about conservation and about the environmental sector in general, is that we are off over here doing something all by ourselves. We are here within the conservation community and the environmental community and anyone who wants to make that positive impact on their environment. But we need that support of all the sectors. So it's truly that integrated approach. So yes, please. We'd love a seat at the table.
Well, I hope everyone who's in the policy world, in the corporate world, is listening and is open-minded like you are. But the question then comes back down to the criticism of plastic production, which is set to increase. And many industry experts are going to tell you that it's because there is demand for the product. There is consumption going on in increasing ways in the developing world. What's some of the craziest things that you've seen?
Well, you're absolutely right. There is demand. And often there's demand for good reason, because these products and these materials work for the environments in which they're being consumed. You know, I'm reflecting on some recent travels that I had in Central Africa, and we were going vast distances and throughout Central Africa into some very remote areas. And throughout that travel, we would pass by marketplaces, right? In the major towns, you'd pass through a market, then in the smaller towns or the smaller kind of corner markets. And as we were doing this, there were, in each of these markets, there were stands that had a vast array, all different colors, all different shapes of these kind of rubberized plastic material shoes. One of the major brands that you may have heard of is Crocs. And that's what it caused me to think of, that throughout this environment, there were Crocs being sold in every one of these communities in all different colors, shapes, and sizes. And I was noticing that, and I was just reflecting on it. And you think about it, in an environment, in a community where water is pervasive, where the ground is wet, where it rains, of course you're going to be looking for a material that dries quickly, that maybe floats if you're living near a water source. So there's demand because these are materials that work for that environment, but it's not necessarily about the demand. It's about that end of life. So what happens after that shoe is no longer useful or no longer wanted? What then happens? So making sure that it doesn't wind up further down in a marine environment or in a water system, a watershed.
It's interesting, right? Everybody wants to be fashionable now, no matter which market. And the idea of plastic and design is probably what also propagated this material as the hero material of the 70s. I mean, I get it, but Does it require education then? Education by people like yourself and Jane and working with companies that can change the ideology behind the consumption itself? Because you guys did it with Mattel, didn't you?
We did. This was such a fun project. And I have to thank and really give a shout out to our partners at Mattel for this project and working together. They were terrific partners. We made the Jane Barbie. And what's fun about this is Jane had been approached to do a Barbie for many years. And she had always said, you know, when the technology is there and we can do it in a sustainable and environmentally responsible way, I'll do it.
I'm guessing she didn't want a whole load of plastic floating around with her face on it.
100%. So we were really pleased to work with Mattel. They had Jane was part of what they call their Inspiring Women series. And so she was a part of that. And the Jane Barbie was made entirely from recycled ocean-bound plastic. It was also certified as a carbon neutral product. All the packaging is recycled. And it was this wonderful, amazing limited edition Jane Barbie that was a really great project to do with such a large manufacturer as Mattel.
It's a fascinating thing where you put your name to something and then you say this is doable in a very constructive way, because at some point we go back to the design of these things and the material being as young. Then the ocean bound bit I get, Anna, because the data is starting to be gathered for ocean bound plastic. We've talked about it quite a bit on the show. And Cardiff University has recently come up with a study where they're predicting the size of the plastic that can be ingested by marine animals. You talked about the marine communities that are gathering plastics on the coastline. You have, you know, all of these different bits of science that are coming out. But where do we come out on in terms of land animals, freshwater, marine life?
Well, you're 100% right that the majority of the research here about the effects of plastic, both on biodiversity and on species, really resides within that marine sector. And it makes sense. It makes total sense. You know, plastics end up in the watersheds and eventually all things flow to the oceans. So that makes good sense. Where we work with more terrestrial species, chimpanzees and primates tend to be around water sources like us. They need fresh water. There has not been a whole lot of research done about the effects of plastic. It is something that I think is an opportunity to learn about and to get some of that data, because as far as we know, there just has not been a whole lot of comprehensive research done on it.
But it would make sense, wouldn't it? Because if it's being generated on land, it is going to first have to go into a river, because you've seen that in Asia, that the source of marine plastic waste is through the Mekong, through the Ganges, where I think the United Nations put out a call saying that two of the most rare freshwater dolphins were now extremely vulnerable in the Mekong Delta and in the Ganges. There's a very cute animal, Anna, that they mentioned called a dugong.
Oh, that's nice.
For anyone who does not know what a dugong is, please Google it. It is the cutest animal I've ever seen. It's like a sea cow, and it's called the ocean's vacuum cleaner. They're endangered now. So I'm curious to see how the data points can be gathered.
Well, first of all, I'm so sorry to hear that such a dear animal is suffering because of this. But I would take issue, I think, bush babies that are found in the forests of Central Africa are probably the cutest species, and baby chimpanzees, of course.
Okay, but you win.
They're so dear. They're so dear. But you know, we can have many favorite species. We can have many, many world's cutest species. To answer your question about finding more data, first of all, the more information, the more we learn, the more opportunity then we have to come up with solutions, the more opportunities we have to create these kinds of innovative approaches to things. So, you know, because there is that void of knowledge, that's a blue space. That's a space that we can go into, we can learn about. Our research is conducted both working with local communities and with the scientific community. And, you know, we welcome the opportunity to learn where there are these blue spaces.
Is that really important to make sure that biodiversity and conservation get put on industry agendas? Or do you think it's going to require something else?
Yeah, I'll come back to what we were talking a little bit about earlier, which is it's important that we're all talking to one another and that there is not a great divide between industry and the environmental sector, between conservation and government, between, you know, these sorts of things. It is absolutely critical in topics especially that are so complex, that are so interwoven, that we are all talking with one another. You know, Jane often talks about the role of heart and head in things, and that when working together with partners, whether it's corporate partners, whether it's industry partners, whether it's governments, that you really need to both have the good science, but you need to appeal to the heart of the individuals there and to bring everyone to the table to see that there is truly this interconnectedness of life and we all have a role to play.
How important do you think, Anna, science and data is to make that possible?
It's very important. You know, there's this analogy of we can disagree whether the glass is half empty or half full, but we all need to agree that the glass has water in it. So the role of science is part of that. The role of science is to bring these observations forward, to bring these hypotheses, to bring these conversations forward. But it really does take that holistic approach and that conversation, that dialogue, to build consensus around some of these larger subjects.
You know what, Anna? It's a great opportunity to kind of think about what you would ask for if you could, because I remember when Lisa first introduced me to Jane, and it was a fantastic opportunity where I was dubbed a fodge, which turns out to be a friend of Jane. I was almost knighted, and it felt so great. It felt like I could be helpful in that particular drive to make a change in this world. For you, what's it going to take?
Well, first of all, fodge is a very great title. That is something you should absolutely be proud of. Any friend of Jane is a very special person, so I'm so happy to hear that you are a fodge. What is it going to take for us? It's really going to take coming together. It's going to take having a seat at the table. Would love to have conversations with the folks at Dow and, you know, even the CEO, if he's interested, about what we can do together, how we can bridge these different industries and these different experiences. And then ultimately, there's this beautiful rallying cry, this invitation that Jane often uses. And it's together we can, together we will, and together we must. Change the world.
And change the world you will, as the future of the Jane Goodall Institute. Anna, thank you so very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. This was such a pleasure, such an honor. Thank you for the conversation.
And the conversation continues in our next episode, when we'll be joined by Jayashree Sate, Chief Science Advocate at 3M, and Carrie Hauptmann, Sustainability Director at Dow, as they share the reality of how business and industry can walk the biodiversity talk. Tune in as we find out. Thanks for sticking with us to the end as we hunt for solutions to make plastics truly circular. This podcast is supported by Dow, one of the world's leading materials science companies. And don't forget to share the show if you enjoyed it. Do leave us a comment or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast.